Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Liotta, and I represent the Edwin Wilson MDE IRA and the James and Sandra Verhoeven Revocable Trust. We're appealing from an order entered by the Green Bay Division of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, confirming the receiver's plan of distribution. The Securities and Exchange Commission commenced an action against Wealth Management LLC and its principals and various relief defendants alleging violations of securities laws and sought the appointment of a receiver.
Before we go any further, you just mentioned that you represented an IRA and a revocable trust. The district court, that's not how the parties are named.
The Edwin Wilson MD IRA and the James P. and Sandra Verhoeven Revocable Trust made an appearance and objected to the plan of distribution in the trial court proceedings. They are not a named party to the case. They are not a named defendant or a relief defendant. They are objectors to the plan.
And they appear as such in this court.
That's correct.
I see.
The appellants contend that the district court abused its discretion when it made an error of law holding that the Wilsons and the Verhoevens were not creditors, even though by contract and by statute they held that status prior to the appointment of the receiver. As creditors, they should be paid prior to equity security holders, and the circuit court order classifying the Wilsons and the Verhoevens as equity owners should be reversed. Approximately 3 weeks ago, the receiver distributed approximately $4.2 million of $6.2 million worth of cash assets and withheld in the estate approximately $2 million. The receiver has stated that these funds are for future administrative expenses, and hopefully some of those funds will be distributed in the future. In addition, the receiver has stated on numerous occasions, including in her last report to the trial court, that there may be other proceeds from collateral litigation that the receiver may obtain as various investments which are now illiquid become liquid, and also there is also some pending litigation contemplated. I raise this because there is a pending motion in front of you to dismiss this appeal on the basis of mootness. At a minimum, based upon this record, we believe that partial relief is possible, if not complete relief, especially in light of the receiver's last report that, as it relates to the Griffin Fund, the fund that both the Wilson and Verhoeven's invested in are the subject of this appeal, there's the potential that there may be yet another $3 million settlement from some litigation that's contemplated involving life insurance. The Griffin Fund is a Wisconsin limited liability company. Limited liability companies are a statutory creation. They are a hybrid between corporations and partnerships. The legislature, with painstaking detail, has addressed what is to happen to former LLC members upon disassociation. These rules of disassociation are published, they are well known, and they are relied upon when people invest in limited liability entities. It is our contention that it is inherently inequitable and unlawful for a receiver or a court to sanction the suspension of those statutory rights and privileges when the beneficiaries of those rights and privileges have not engaged in any illegal or inequitable conduct.
How do you get around the language of Section 959B?
Section 959B provides that the receiver is to administer the estate or operate or manage the estate consistent with state law. There is a difference between the reported decisions in terms of whether that statute applies in a so-called liquidation context. We've cited the court to the Sixth Circuit decision that it doesn't matter whether the receiver is managing and operating the business or whether it's in liquidation mode, because what's important is the receiver should be liquidating the estate for the benefit of creditors. So we believe that the Sixth Circuit view should be adopted by this circuit.
That's a minority position, as I understand the case law.
That would be correct, Your Honor, but I guess I would like to argue in favor of the minority position and point out the following to the court. If the receiver's position is adopted in this case, basically the receiver is taking the position that there is no restraint whatsoever on the receiver's powers other than court supervision.
Okay, before we get to policy arguments, let's start with the language of the statute.
All right.
Which, as I understand it, was Judge Ripple's question. Is there a language from the is there an argument flowing from the text of the statute that supports you?
Yes, there is. And I would argue to you that there, in this particular case, because we're dealing with an investment pool, which by definition owns securities, sells securities, monetizes securities, distributes that money to the investors, that is no different than so-called liquidation. I think liquidation in this particular case is a distinction without a difference, because the receiver, in effect, is managing and operating the fund. She's just selling and then monetizing. She's not reinvesting, but that's exactly what the managers of Gryphon Fund would be doing anyway. So when we're dealing with a unique case like an unregistered investment pool such as this, I don't believe that liquidation versus managing an operation as defined in Section 959B has any meaningful impact on the outcome of this case.
If we look at the state law, why don't we look at the Wisconsin Securities Act as well as looking at the LLP Act?
In this particular case, for this particular fund, it is a limited liability company, and so we believe that the operative legal provisions that would govern the relationship of the parties would come under the LLC Act as opposed to the Wisconsin version of the Uniform Securities Act.
Let me go back to my original question. I may not have been clear. I understand that these your clients were objectors, but did they appear individually, or did they in the district court, or did they appear with respect to their revocable trust in the IRA? Did the revocable trust in the IRA appear as objectors, or did the parties themselves? What I'm getting at is I'm wondering if your notice of appeal violates Appellate Rule 3, to name the wrong parties for the appeal.
As it relates to the Edwin Wilson IRA, looking at the court docket, which would be 84, we appeared on behalf of the Edwin Wilson MD RIA by its attorney, objects to the receiver's plan. So as it relates to the Wilsons, I believe we are consistent, Judge. As it appears as to the Verhovens, another law firm appeared for them in the trial court level. Your Honor, you are correct. The prior firm had appeared on behalf of the James P. Verhoeven and Sandra J. Verhoeven, and not the revocable trust. And that's at document 77 in the trial court record.
Thank you.
I would like to again address the statutes at 183. They're cited at length in the brief. I noticed that the white light is already on, so I'm going to try to finish up here quickly to reserve some time for rebuttal. The statutes provide that upon disassociation, the Wilsons and the Verhovens have the status and remedies of creditors. That's by statute. The cases that the receiver cites many times are cases where the objector, the investor, is trying to elevate themselves using equitable remedies, such as the remedy of restitution, tracing, constructive trust. This is not that type of case. We are relying upon statutory and contractual rights and not equitable remedies in asserting our position. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Faye Feinstein. I am the court-appointed receiver for Wealth Management and its six investment funds. I was appointed to replace the principals of Wealth Management who were accused of, among other things, misrepresenting the nature, extent, and safety of the investments that were entrusted to them. My directive by the district court was to implement a plan for the equitable distribution of Wealth Management's funds assets to its investors.
So you were in liquidation mode from the get-go. This was never going to be operated or managed as a going concern.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, the funds were in liquidation mode before I was appointed. The plan provides for the distribution of what's left of over $100 million that had been placed for investment with Wealth Management by 105 individual investors holding some 300 separate investment accounts. The investors are predominantly elderly. Most are retired, and they place their life savings with Wealth Management. Many of the investments are held in IRA or 401k accounts. After the plan was approved, the objectors requested the district court to stay distributions. The request was denied. The same request was made to this court. The request was denied. Only then did I comply with my fiduciary duties to distribute to investors. To date, I have recovered just over $6 million and do not expect the recoveries to be anywhere near the $100 million that has been lost. It's become clear that investors have suffered staggering losses and will recover only pennies on the dollar. I'd like to address the motion to dismiss first, if I may. In accordance with the plan, after both requests for a stay were denied, I distributed approximately $4.3 million and issued 226 checks, ranging from approximately $11 in the Watchstone Fund to $162,000 in the Griffin Fund. The average check was approximately $18,000. The percentage recovery ranged from a low of 0.5% in the Watchstone Fund to 57% in the Katzal Fund. Two days after I made the distribution, I filed the motion to dismiss or affirm. Although I do expect the estate to remain open for quite some time, it is unknown how much more will come in to distribute. The amounts that come in to distribute are dependent on the 20 sub-investments that are invested, that the hedge funds have invested in. Each of those is in its own liquidation. And so there is a time delay until I can recover those funds from the sub-funds.
There was a reference from the podium to litigation settlement forthcoming or potentially forthcoming?
That's not entirely accurate. There is potential litigation that we are considering. I'm very cautious about what litigation we might entertain because every dollar that we spend comes right out of the funds and is a dollar less for these people to receive. What we were referring to and what counsel was referring to is one of the subfunds is invested in life insurance premium financing, and one of the life insurance policies is payable due to the death of the deceased. The insured doesn't want to pay. It's a $10 million policy. There may or there may not be litigation. The beneficiaries, the family of the insureds, also have a claim to some of that money. We projected for the benefit of the investors that if we were to litigate, we might reasonably expect approximately $3 million. That $3 million would not be spread across all the funds. There are six separate funds. So it is not known at this time whether there will be litigation or whether there will be recoveries. But sadly, I can say that most of the $100 million has been lost. In light of the distribution, we argue that the plan has been substantially implemented and that it would be inequitable to unwind or rewrite it at this time. The court addressed just this issue in the Wozniak case, which was also a receivership case, and this court analogized to the bankruptcy concept of substantial consummation. This court stated, if a plan has been carried out so that providing relief to an objector would require rescinding it and forcing a host of innocent third parties to return the money, the court will not entertain the objection. This court also found in UNR that there's no practical difference between a stay denied and a stay not requested. They both lead to the same result, implementation of the plan and reliance thereon, making it difficult to unwind. The inquiry is not whether it's possible to fashion some relief. To overturn the plan, this court needs to address whether it would be prudent to do that. This is because we must consider the effect of the distribution and the effect of the relief requested on the innocent victims in this case who have now relied on the checks they have received. In UNR, this court placed a heavy burden on an objector to come up with a powerful reason to overturn the plan. Objectors have not met that burden. First, they argue that the plan should be overturned and the investor should return the distributions because I shouldn't have distributed the money while the appeal was pending. That position ignores the fact that their request for a stay was denied twice by the district court and by this court. That situation is no different than had they not requested a stay. The investors had a right to rely on the distributions, and I had a fiduciary duty to distribute in accordance with the plan that was confirmed. In fact, the objector's motion for a stay to this court conceded that without a stay, I would distribute the money, effectively depriving them of any opportunity to reverse the transactions. That concession precludes their contrary argument today. Next, the objectors argue...
What was the largest amount that you say that you've distributed?
$162,000 in one check.
And most of them, though, were much smaller?
Many of them. The average check was $18,000. The objectors also argue it would be easy for me to get the money back because, after all, the investors are wealthy and all they have to do is write a check. But with the average check of $18,000, I think it would be unreasonable to assume that anyone is going to willingly just write a check. In fact, the objectors stated and conceded in their motion for a stay that without a stay, if the money were distributed, the investors would spend the money before effectively depriving them of a remedy. Many cases, the proceeds of the distribution have been deposited to IRA and 401k accounts, making it effectively impossible for them to just write a check without a tax consequence and making it difficult for me to obtain the check. I would have to engage in disgorgement litigation, which would be, I think, grossly inequitable to those investors who have suffered enough. Finally, the objectors argue it would be easy to scrap a plan and rewrite another one. But the question is not whether it's easy to rewrite the plan, but whether doing so and taking another plan through the confirmation process will diminish estate resources. And that is beyond dispute. The same circumstance existed in the Capital Consultants case in the Ninth Circuit, where the circuit also was reviewing a district court's determination in an equity receivership after distributions had been made, and analogizing to the bankruptcy concept, of substantial consummation, the circuit court found that the plan should not be undone due to the complexity of recalculating distributions and the inability to obtain disgorgement at a reasonable cost. For all of these reasons, we would urge this court to do the same, as the objectors have not met their burden to present a powerful reason to overturn the plan at this time. But I'd also like to address the merits. The plan is funded on two linked principles. First, that all investors were similarly situated victims of the conduct alleged in the SEC's complaint, and they all suffered equally devastating losses of their life savings. And secondly, that the economic impact of wealth management's failure should be spread as evenly as possible among all of the investors, and none should receive preferential treatment, since in a zero-sum game, favoring some investors necessarily disfavors others. The issue is whether the district court abused its discretion in approving a plan that treats all investors equally and doesn't prefer some over others, and whether the offset provisions of the plan were within the district court's discretion. Although the objectors call themselves creditors, the nature and origin of their claims are as equity holders. Their interests are fundamentally different than creditors who may have loaned money or provided goods and services to the fund. Since my goal has been to achieve a distribution that is equitable to all and not to the few that want to jump to the head of the line, I've treated the objectors and similarly situated redeeming investors as equity holders along with all other investors. The alternative would be to prefer those redeeming investors at the expense of others, and they would effectively take all the proceeds that I have and all that are to come to the detriment of everyone else. There are three reasons why the district court did not abuse its discretion in approving a pro rata plan. First, the district court's authority does not flow from 28 U.S.C. 959, as the objectors have suggested in their pleadings. It flows from the inherent and broad power of a court of equity to fashion effective relief. As the district court noted in the Enterprise Trust case, there are no hard rules governing a district court's decisions in matters like these. The standard is whether a distribution is equitable and fair in the eyes of a reasonable judge. The court went on to note that nothing is really out of bounds for receivers. Here, the district court's decision was reasonable and equitable and garnered the consent of virtually all investors. Of 105 investors, only six objected. Second, the investors' interests are the same as all other equity holders. We don't dispute the general premise that creditors should be paid before equity holders. But even if they are creditors under state law, which we contest, that does not give them a right to preferred treatment here. As the origin of their claim is an equity investment, and that is not subject to dispute. The district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that preferring the objectors would place form over substance. The district court relied on this court's decision in Envirodyne, which we think is highly persuasive. In that case, the objector's claims also arose from a redemption request that was not honored. The objectors argued that under Delaware law, they were legally entitled to be treated as creditors and be paid ahead of everyone else. This court agreed that their claims were legally those of creditors, but subordinated them so as to be treated pro rata with all other equity holders. The court looked to the substance of the transaction and found that the claims were in substance equity interests, and that the objectors there, as the objectors here, and as all other equity holders, had all accepted the same risks when they invested in the funds, including the risk of enterprise insolvency. The fact that Delaware law in that case converted the objectors' interests into debt rather than equity did not affect this court's decision, as the goal, as it is here, is the fair distribution of the assets of the estate.
It's not clear to me that Wisconsin law converted these redeemers' interest to debt based on the statutes that have been invoked here, because they appeared to incorporate the operating agreements.
It's our position, Your Honor, that even if we would be required to look at state law, that the state law does not require that they be treated as creditors. The statutes at issue all defer to the operating agreement. The operating agreement is clear Whether objectors read it before they signed on is unknown, but it's clear, and it gives total discretion to the managing member, not only in terms of the investments to be made, but whether and when to make distributions. And the discretion extends to extraordinary circumstances, including circumstances where there simply wouldn't be enough money to go around. And in fact, the objectors' briefs point out that in February of 2008, a letter went from the managing member of the Griffin Fund to the investors informing them, and a similar letter went to investors in the Watchstone Fund informing them that there wasn't enough money to go around, and they were lowering a gate and not making any payments to those who had requested redemption because there simply wasn't enough money.
And the operating agreement permits that sort of suspension of
payments. Yes, it does.
So to the extent that Wisconsin law applies.
Yes, it does. I know that my time is up, but if I might have just 30 more seconds, Your Honor, because there was a lot of discussion about Section 959. Section, as Your Honor pointed out, the bulk of the case law provides that Section 959 doesn't apply to a liquidating trustee or receiver. However, even if it does, it applies in a very limited circumstance in order to preclude regulatory law that protects the public health and safety. And in fact, the most recent federal court statements on this issue is in the Chrysler case, which is more on point here. In that case, the objectors argued that state dealership law required that they be given preferred treatment in that liquidating bankruptcy case. And the court held that 959 does not require a trustee to comply with state statutes that are concerned with protecting private, economic, or commercial interests. That's what we're dealing with here. These are not regulatory laws, but these are statutes that deal with private economic interests, and they're simply not at issue.
The Sixth Circuit case had to do with environmental protection and hazardous waste disposal?
Yes, it did. And even in that case, Your Honor, which was the wall tube case, the court stated, our holding does not mean that all trustees must comply with all state statutes protecting public health and safety. And the court went back to the Supreme Court's opinion in the Mid-Atlantic case, which expressly did not address circumstances where state laws may be so onerous as to interfere with bankruptcy adjudication itself. And the Envirodyne case, I thought, also crystallized it when they said that while state law may determine the validity of a claim, it doesn't determine the priority of distribution. That issue is left to the discretion of the Court of Equity. Thank you.
I'll give you another minute, too, since we went over.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the receiver's arguments regarding mootness, I believe the receiver concedes that there's $2 million in the estate right now over a number of funds. There's the potential of getting other assets into this estate over time. I think under the case law, there is the opportunity for this court or the trial court to render partial relief, so therefore the appeal is not moot. As it relates to the LLC creditor issue that the receiver raised in oral argument, I do believe that the LLC statute does confer the creditor status. 183.0606 specifically refers granting the disassociated member the rights and remedies of creditors. And the receiver is correct. The law also provides that where the operating agreement controls, we refer to the operating agreement. The operating agreement in this particular case, and I believe the provisions are 5.1 and 5.3, and they're in our appendix, basically provides that when a member of the fund disassociates and seeks withdrawal, and the withdrawal is recognized, the payment is to be made in approximately 60 days. Then there's also additional language which would indicate that in extraordinary circumstances, the manager of the fund does have the discretion not to make the payment. The key here for you, and I believe that it's outcome determinative here, the Verhoevens and the Wilsons had placed in their request for complete withdrawal almost a year prior to the appointment of the receiver. The 60 days had lapsed. At that point in time, both of them had the rights of creditors. And I believe that the appropriate analysis should be, when taking a look at the plan and classifying interests, is when the receivership estate is formed, that estate is going to have certain rights against third parties, and obviously there's going to be obligations of that estate to third parties. At the point in time the receiver was appointed in this case, the Wilsons and the Verhovens, under applicable statutory law and under the contract documents themselves, had the status of creditor. Yes, the standard is that the receivership plan needs to sensibly categorize the interests of the claimant. We submit that it is not sensible to subordinate the Wilsons or the Verhovens or anyone else who disassociated from the plan, because that, in effect, would deprive them of their contractual rights and their statutory rights. And there is no case law out there that gives a receiver super avoidance type powers that the receiver has sought in this case. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.